Hey everyone, and welcome to a deep dive that's been tailored just for you. Today, we're tackling company valuation.
You sent us fundamentals of company valuation, and it seems like you're ready to move beyond just surface-level stuff about balance sheets, which is really cool.
And the best part is we've got a financial expert with us to help us break it all down.
We're going to explore those sometimes mysterious financial forces, decode those market signals, and maybe even uncover some hidden gems along the way.
Imagine you've inherited a company. Congratulations, by the way.
You're suddenly the CEO, but there's a catch. You have absolutely no idea what this company is actually worth.
So where do we even begin?
Well, it's all about building a solid foundation, and that starts with understanding the financial DNA of any company. Debt and equity.
Debt and equity.
Mm.
Okay, I think I've heard those terms before, but for those of us who don't speak fluent finance, can you break it down?
Think about buying a house.
Debt is essentially the mortgage. That's the money you borrow from a lender to buy the asset, in this case, your company. Equity, on the other hand, is like your down payment, the portion you're directly putting into the business.
So with the company, who are the lenders exactly? Are we talking about just going into a bank and asking for a company loan?
Well, it could be a bank, but it could also be investment funds
mm-hmm.
or even individuals. And just like with a house, you've got different levels of debt.
You've got senior debt. That's the most secure type. That's like your first mortgage lenders get priority if the company hits a rough patch, so lower interest rates.
Then there's junior debt. It's riskier, but can come with higher returns for the lender. Think of it like a second mortgage.
And then finally, there's equity, which can be divided into preferred equity and common equity, different ownership levels with different levels of control and potential upside.
Okay, so if I'm following you, junior debt, because it's riskier, demands a higher interest rate. Because if our company doesn't become what we hope, the lender's taking a bigger risk.
Exactly. Higher risk, higher potential reward. That's a really fundamental principle in finance.
That makes sense. Now, everyone wants good returns, right? We've got debt, we've got equity, but how does it all translate into actually making money?
This is where the magic of compounding returns comes into play. It's not just about the simple interest you earn. It's about earning interest on your interest. It's like a financial snowball.
So even small differences in return can become huge gains over time. That's amazing.
Absolutely. And understanding this is so important when you're trying to value a company. You're not just looking at today's price tag. It's also about the potential return compounding over time. That's how you build wealth, slowly but surely.
It's like planting a tree.
The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, but the second best time is today.
So compounding, it's about playing that long game.
But before we get too excited about potential returns, we've got to talk about something that sounds almost too good to be true. No arbitrage. What's that all about?
No arbitrage basically means that in a sensible market, you can't just make money out of thin air. There are no free lunches in finance, no guaranteed ways to make a quick buck without taking on some risk.
Okay, so what you're saying is those get-rich-quick schemes.
Probably too good to be true, right? What a shocker. But seriously, how does no arbitrage actually work in the real world? Can you give us an example?
Imagine finding a $20 bill just lying there on the sidewalk.
Sure, it might happen sometimes. But in a busy city, chances are someone else is going to grab it first.
Right.
That's kind of like arbitrage, those like rare opportunities that vanish quickly because investors are always on the lookout.
Now, let's say our inherited company is generating a steady stream of profit.
Technically, we could borrow money at a certain interest rate and buy the whole company, using the profits to pay off the debt. If that interest rate is low enough, it seems like we're making money without putting any money down.
Wow, that sounds pretty good.
But that's where this no arbitrage thing steps in, right? To burst that bubble.
Right. In a normal market, this scenario won't last. Other investors would catch on, the price of the company would go up, and that free lunch disappears. This constant buying and selling, everyone chasing profits, it's what generally keeps markets efficient, at least in theory.
So it's like this invisible force keeping things balanced.
Yeah.
No arbitrage, like financial gravity or something.
Exactly. That's a great way to put it. And it makes a really important point. When you're thinking about an investment, you've got to be realistic. Don't just focus on what you might earn. Think about the risks. And if something looks too good to be true.
It probably is.
That's some good advice, both financially and in life. But how do we actually figure out a fair price for our company? Not a total steal, but not a ripoff either. How do we find that sweet spot?
That's where net present value comes in, or NPV. Imagine you could choose between getting $100 today or $100 a year from now. What would you choose?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I'd probably take the $100 now.
A bird in hand is worth two in the bush, or something like that.
Yeah.
You've got the right idea. That's basically NPV money today is worth more than that same amount later on.
NPV helps us put a number on that difference, factoring in things like inflation and what we could earn otherwise. It's like asking, what are those future earnings worth to me today?
Okay, so when we're looking at our inherited company, it's not just about what we might make years down the line, but what those potential profits are actually worth to us right now in this moment.
Exactly. NPV helps us make a fair comparison, dollar for dollar, over time. But remember, it's a tool, not a crystal ball.
Wait, so NPV isn't foolproof? What's the catch?
Well, to calculate it, we have to make assumptions about the future, like how fast the company's going to grow, how much it'll cost to borrow money. These are basically educated guesses, and even the best projections can be thrown off by stuff we just don't see coming.
So just like with anything in finance, due diligence is key. Don't just blindly trust one number, even if it is called net present value. We need to step back, look at the big picture, understand the assumptions, and be prepared for the unexpected.
Well, absolutely. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results, right?
But it's still important. I get it. But what if our company wants to grow, like maybe invest in new equipment or do some big marketing push? How do we factor that in?
You're talking about capital expenditures, basically. The money a company spends to keep things running or even expand.
Think of it like keeping the company's engine going, maybe even giving it a turbocharge.
We deduct those capital expenditures from the company's earnings to figure out how profitable it truly is.
Makes sense. It's not just about how much you earn, but what you actually keep after those essential costs.
But what about other costs, like taxes? Those always seem to come out of nowhere.
Ah, yes. Taxes, can't forget those. We need to determine the effective tax rate for the company.
That rate can be different depending on the industry, where the company's located, a bunch of factors.
Once we know the taxman's share, we can then calculate the after-tax profits, a more accurate look at the company's earning power.
Okay, so we've considered the cost of doing business, accounted for those pesky taxes, and now we have a pretty good understanding of how profitable this company is. But realistically, most investors are playing the long game.
We're thinking about what our investment will be worth years down the line when we're ready to cash out. So how do we determine that future value?
That's where the exit multiple comes in.
Let's say we're selling our company years from now. This exit multiple helps us estimate its selling price based on its earnings at that future time.
It's like using financial ratios to guide our predictions rather than just throwing darts at a board.
Ratios. Sounds a little intimidating, but tell me more.
One common one, and very useful, is the EVITA multiple.
EV stands for enterprise value. Basically, the company's total worth, including both debt and equity. EBITDA, we touched upon that earlier, right? It measures operating earnings.
By dividing that enterprise value by EBITDA, we can see how much the market might be willing to shell out for each dollar of the company's earnings.
So, if the EBITDA multiple is higher, does that mean the market is willing to pay more for the company's earnings? Is that a good thing? Does it mean it's a better investment?
Not necessarily. It's all relative.
A higher multiple could mean great growth potential, a competitive edge, even just market hype. A lower one, on the other hand, could mean it's undervalued or riskier, or maybe it's just not in a very exciting industry.
It's crucial to compare those multiples within the same industry and look at what's going on with the specific company.
So just like in real estate, it's all about location.
But in the stock market, it's all about dot context.
Exactly. But how do you know what's a good multiple in the first place? Well, it requires some detective work.
We have to dive into those financials, look at how the company's grown over time, figure out its competition, and keep an eye on overall market trends. It's like piecing together a puzzle.
I'm feeling like a financial Sherlock Holmes here, but let's get back to our hypothetical company. We have our projected earnings, we've factored in those capital expenditures, those taxes, we even have an estimated exit multiple. What now? How do we use all of that to get a final valuation?
That, my friend, is where financial modeling comes in.
Think of it as building a virtual version of the company's future. It connects today's numbers to our long-term projections.
So like a financial crystal ball, but instead of vague predictions, it uses real data, logical assumptions, and a touch of, shall we say, financial magic. What goes into a typical financial model?
It starts with projecting the company's future earnings.
How much do we expect it to bring in each year? Usually we look at a time frame of 5 to 10 years.
We look at its history, industry forecasts, and the company's own plans.
So looking at where it's been, where it's going, and what the competition's up to.
You got it. Then we layer in those capital expenditure assumptions. how much investment is needed for growth or just to keep things running.
And of course, those taxes, using that effective tax rate we talked about. And finally, we bring in our exit multiple to estimate what the company might be worth at the end of our projected period.
It's like building a financial roadmap for the company, mapping its potential path from today into the future.
But there are so many things we can't predict, right? What if those assumptions are wrong?
That's the thing about financial modeling. It's both an art and a science.
We're making informed guesses using the best information we have. We can't predict everything, but we can develop different scenarios, stress test our assumptions, get a range of potential outcomes.
So instead of one single valuation, we end up with multiple possibilities.
Sort of like a best case, worst case, most likely kind of thing.
Exactly. And by figuring out the key drivers behind that valuation, the assumptions that really make a difference, we can focus our energy where it matters most, make smarter decisions.
I see. So we've covered so much. Debt and equity, compounding, no arbitrage, NPV, these financial ratios, and even those complex leveraged buyouts. I feel like I should get an honorary finance degree.
You've been an excellent student, but remember, this is just the beginning.
Keep exploring, maybe take a closer look at the Hilton case study we mentioned, and don't ever be afraid to question those valuations.
Great advice. But before we wrap up, I have one last question for you. How do you think things like AI and automation will affect how we value companies in the future?
Will these methods we've talked about still be relevant when we have so many intangible assets and technology is constantly evolving?
Now, that's the million-dollar question. It's something experts are trying to figure out right now.
It will be really interesting to see how those valuation methods adapt in the years to come.
Definitely fascinating. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into company valuation. Until next time, everyone.
We're diving deep into those financial reports, comparing things like debt-to-equity ratios, price-to-earnings ratios.
We're trying to see if there are any warning signs or hidden opportunities. It's like we're financial detectives looking for clues.
Exactly. And we really have to look closely at management's projections for how Hilton would perform. Were they being a little too optimistic, maybe caught up in the excitement of it all?
Or did their projections actually line up with the company's past growth and what was happening in the industry?
It reminds me of when you're buying a used car.
You want to make sure that the mileage is accurate and the seller's not hiding any problems.
That's a great analogy.
Hmm.
And with something like an LBO where there's a lot of debt involved, future cash flow is so important.
The company has to make enough money to cover not just its regular expenses, but also those big interest payments on the debt.
It's like having a huge mortgage, right? You better be able to make those monthly payments or you could lose it all.
Exactly. We'd also want to know how well Hilton could handle paying back that debt.
How long would it take? What were the interest rates? These are all critical when you're figuring out if an LBO makes sense or not.
Wow, I had no idea there was so much involved in valuing a company. We've talked about debt, equity, compounding, that no arbitrage principle, NPV, all those financial ratios, and even LBOs. I feel like I've gotten a crash course in finance today.
You've been a great sport. But remember, this deep dive is just the beginning.
Keep exploring. Check out the details of that Hilton case study if you're interested. And don't be afraid to ask questions and really dig into those valuations.
That's great advice. Before we go, I've been thinking, how do you think AI and automation are going to change how companies are valued in the future?
Will these methods we've been talking about hold up in a world where intangible assets are becoming more and more important and technology is constantly changing?
That's a great question and something experts are debating right now.
It'll be interesting to see how things evolve over the next few years.
Definitely. This has been a fascinating look at the world of company valuation. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive. Until next time.